The Oracle Network.
Due to the graphic nature and content of this podcast, listener discretion is advised.
Victimology. I'm your host, Melissa Lee. I hope everyone out there in podcast land is doing just swell. And please tell me you all are continuing to wash your hands for the love of God. Well, happy early Halloween, everyone. I hope everyone has their Halloween costumes all picked out and you've got your candy ready to go. I sure don't, so maybe I should at this point. Something kind of fun my work is doing is we're doing a costume contest, not for us, but for our pets and children. Now, I don't know how you can put pets and children in the same category costume-wise, but it's surely going to be a very interesting thing. But so that's something fun we're kind of doing. I have yet to pick up my candy yet, though. Oh, I should probably do that. Come to think of it. Note to self, we'll have to handle that. I'm really excited to jump into this week's episode. It's definitely a doozy. So without further ado, let's get on into it. During the spookiest time of the year, I think a lot of us reflect on cases that have shaken us to our core. During this episode, I will be talking about just that, a case that has given me chills even to this day reading about it. That is the case of Henry McCabe. I must say, the first time I heard about this case, I was listening to a very popular true crime podcast that shall remain nameless, but I can vividly remember sitting at my desk almost shaking from listening to the details surrounding this case. I will be playing clips from a voicemail that some listeners may consider extremely disturbing, so listener discretion is very much so advised. Henry McCabe seemed to be living the American dream. He immigrated to America from Liberia. His family was very active in the Liberian American community while living in California. Henry and his wife, Corrine, had been married for 11 years and had two children together. He and his wife and daughters decided to move to Mounds View, Minnesota, where he ultimately ended up working as an auditor for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. According to Bizarre Unsolved's write-up on the case, he was described as being outgoing, friendly, and outspoken. A well-rounded and very fun person to be around. He was a family man and had a very stable career. He was only 32 years old when tragedy would ultimately strike. September 6, 2015 seemed to be just a normal day in Henry's life, except his wife, Corrine, and their children were in California at the time, so that's just something to remember along the way. Nothing was really amiss that day. By that evening, Henry had bumped into an acquaintance from Liberia. Now, his name was William Kennedy. Later that evening, he and William would go out to meet more friends at Povlitsky's, which is a local bar or club. Now, I've heard it called a bar and a club, but according to their website, they are a sports bar. So that settles that. This bar was located in Spring Lake Park, which is about 5 minutes away driving from where Henry lived in Mounds View. Henry and friends stayed out until the bar closed early the next morning. Yet again, nothing seemed to be amiss during this boys' night, except for one weird little detail. Henry's friends decided to take his wallet so he would stop buying drinks, and they decided to take his keys as well. Now, is this necessarily that weird? No, But given the future events, this could be potentially suspicious, let's say. This was the last time anyone besides William Kennedy would see Henry alive. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back, everyone. Speaking of suspicious, let's get into the shady details surrounding Henry's last whereabouts. The guys all decide to leave the bar around 2 a.m. Henry ended up going with William Kennedy in William's car. After speaking with investigators, William informed them that Henry supposedly requested to be dropped off at a gas station in the complete opposite direction of his home. This gas station was supposedly located in Fridley, which is about a 6-minute drive from where the bar was located in Spring Lake Park. And most importantly, I say again to reiterate, the opposite direction from Henry's home. Well, regardless, William then took Henry to the gas station. Now, there were some mix-ups about exactly which gas station Henry was dropped off at. William reportedly was confused and initially told investigators that he had dropped Henry off at the Super America gas station, which was on the corner of 65th and 73rd Avenue. He supposedly was so sure of this that he brought investigators to the station and showed them where he dropped him off. However, there was one little problem. The surveillance video that was approximately 7 minutes away at the Holiday gas station at intersection Central Ave and Hackman Avenue showed footage of Henry literally being dropped off there, not at the Super America gas station. Now, typically, this is where the story would end, right? Victim is last seen and disappears. No, not really in this case. Approximately 2:23 a.m. on September 7th, 2015, Corrine received a distressing call from Henry. The noises were inhumane and completely disturbing. For 2 minutes, she listened to what she believed to be her husband screaming that someone had shot him. The line then goes quiet and she hears someone say, "Stop it." The only reason the call was recorded is because Corrine had called Tim Borber, Henry's biological brother. It went to his voicemail, hence the 2-minute recording of Henry screaming and making very strange noises. Now, keep in mind, it's approximately 2:30 in the morning. Quite early, so Tim did not hear the message until the next day. There is some confusion surrounding the actual recording and the calls. It is believed to have been released and then completely taken down from the internet. At least that's the rumor going around. While I am unsure of what actually happened, I do know that ABC released a broadcast with portions of the recording, which I will play now. Again, listener discretion is advised.
It's a voicemail unlike anything you've ever heard before. There are 2 minutes worth of noises, bizarre ones, but very little actual talking. Authorities confirmed the disturbing middle-of-the-night call came from Henry McCabe's cell phone. It was Labor Day, September 7th at 2:28 in the morning. McCabe's worried wife heard the message.
His and my cell phone connected.
Minnesota Community Policing Services is a nonprofit agency. It acts as a go-between with police and the Liberian community. The leader is trying to help the family make some sense of this recording.
The growls turned to high-pitched moans. So,
like he's moaning in pain.
The tortured grunts suddenly stop. There is silence. Then someone, either Henry or another person, says, "Stop it."
I try to picture where he was, what it might have been like, what circumstances would have made him sound like that.
The voicemail is in stark contrast to other articulate recordings of McCabe speaking at an event. He's a state auditor.
What is the justification? What is the right thing to do?
The message is one piece of evidence Moundsview police are reviewing. The police chief tells me even the FBI is analyzing the recording and voices for clues. The chief says the investigation took deputies here on Tuesday to Rice Creek Park, which borders New Brighton, Moundsview, and Fridley, all areas where McCabe was reported seen or a cell phone ping placed him. Ramsey County Water Patrol searched, but came up empty.
I literally get goosebumps whenever I listen to that recording because it's so disturbing. So let's talk a little bit about the calls that were made. Henry made three separate phone calls early that morning. I do not know which actually was the call that made the recording. Now, the calls pinged all over. One pinged in Spring Lake Park, one in Fridley, and the other in New Brighton. I have to take a second to hype up Bizarre Unsolved. They did such a thorough write-up on this case, and if you want to check out the link down below. You can actually see the map points where the gas stations were, as well as where the phone pinged that night. They literally talk about within a 30-minute time span, Henry's phone pinged on towers in three separate cities. They make a point to say that he was on foot with no money and no keys in the middle of the night. Again, something to note from the Bizarre Unsolved article, they show the pings on the map and how far of a distance there was between them. Now, it would have approximately taken him a half an hour between each of these points to get to where the phone pinged, if that makes sense. I personally think this is because he was in the general vicinity. That's why his phone pinged at three separate towers. Now, am I a cell tower expert? No. But that's just what my gut is telling me, because as we know in other cases, you can be in the general vicinity and your phone can ping at multiple different towers. Let's talk a little bit more about the voicemail. Something I had mentioned earlier and I want to touch again on is that Henry had supposedly told his wife that he had been shot. I do not know if this was actually recorded or not, because, hey, we don't have the actual full recording, right? But clearly, this is something that will come up later on in this episode, so keep that little tidbit in your mind. What I do want to focus on is the noises he was making. There are tons of rabbit holes one can go down while looking into this case. Does it sound like someone who was shot, or does it sound like something else? And what about the other possible voice on the voicemail saying, "Stop it"? Someone on Reddit had pointed out that it almost sounds like someone is being waterboarded. Now, Henry was reported missing on September 8th, 2015. Right from the get-go, investigators were highly concerned by the suspicious voicemail. One investigator even mentions how concerning the voicemail was in the ABC interview, as well as what he heard on it. After speaking to family, investigators turned their attention to the last known person to see Henry alive, William Kennedy. As previously mentioned, investigators were originally told that William dropped Henry off at one gas station instead of the one down the road where security camera footage was ultimately found to be the site where Henry was dropped off at. William also made it very clear to investigators that they were merely acquaintances and not that close. He ultimately denied having anything to do with Henry's disappearance. It was then found out that William was the one who kept Henry's keys. Now, they do not mention any reasons as to why he did that. Could have he just left him in the car? It's very possible. Something else they don't mention is why Henry wanted to be dropped off at a gas station if his home was merely minutes away. Something is really fishy here. The Minnesota Community Policing Services recommend immediate search and rescue efforts to begin. Volunteers help comb through the areas to help find Henry. For 3 months, people continued to look for Henry. It was during search efforts that they realized the information about the gas station was incorrect. Yet again, was this on purpose or an honest mistake? I don't know. The search for Henry McCabe ended on November 2nd, 2015, when a body was discovered at Rush Lake in New Brighton by a kayaker. It was very evident the body had been there for some time. The water patrol had been sent out to retrieve the body. However, it was very apparent identification was going to be extremely difficult due to the fact the body was so decomposed. They could not determine his race, gender, or age by looking at the body. 2 days later, it was ultimately determined the body was that of Henry McCabe. On November 20th, the autopsy results were released. It was found that his cause of death would probably be drowning. No signs of gunshot wounds, or really any wounds of any kind. No defensive wounds. Which contradicts what Corrine reported that Henry had said on the phone. So it begs the question, what happened to Henry McCabe that fateful night? We'll be right back. All right, everyone, welcome back. Honestly, this case just has completely boggled my mind, and I have so many thoughts and questions. So let's chat about some of them. Henry's acquaintance, emphasis on acquaintance, William. Why did he, A, let Henry leave the bar without his wallet, B, drop him off at the gas station going away from his home at 2 in the morning, C, end up with his keys, and D, tell investigators he dropped him off at one gas station instead of the real location? I'd also like to know exactly how much both of them had to drink. This is something I have not been able to exactly find. The only indicator we have is that Henry's friends took his wallet from him. He was clearly drinking quite a bit and continued to buy drink after drink, so they took it away from him so he could stop. Now, how did Henry end up going home with William? Did they drive together that night? It almost seems that way, as Henry ran into William and appears to have brought him with to the boys' night at the bar. I would infer that Henry had to have been somewhat inebriated, being he forgot his wallet and that William had his keys. Why did Henry ask to get dropped off at the gas station? If I were William, I'd sure want to know why you'd be going there after a night of partying. Could it have been something as innocent as wanting a snack or needing something from the convenience store? How do you forget a 7-minute drive between gas stations? Was William somewhat drunk and completely lost track of the area? Or did he intentionally lead investigators astray? Did Henry make those calls himself, or did he pocket dial his wife? Most reports I've read on the case say that he made a total of 3 calls. According to a report from The Cinemaholic, there were some reports that claimed they found his phone taken apart with the phone in one pocket and the battery in the other. And what about the cell phone pings? The radius was approximately a 30-minute walk in between them. Did Henry walk into something heinous, or was he intentionally brought there? Now, there's also some reports that Corrine McCabe was withholding information from the police and that she was not cooperating with the investigation. Which, if this is the case, does she know more about her husband's death than she's letting on? According to the Spokesman Recorder, apparently, Henry's brother would be the one to call him in as a missing person. I know if I were to receive a call like that from my spouse, I'd be calling the police the second I received that call. But maybe she thought it was typical boys' night behavior? Or maybe something more sinister was at play? I found an article where Fox 9 had done a one-on-one interview with Corrine, and she had wondered if someone had possibly put something in Henry's drink. Now, that's a thought I personally had not had. But it definitely begs to question, is that why Henry was making the noises he was making on the phone? She also reported that while on the call, she heard Henry mutter, "They are afraid," and "police." There was one other word that Henry said at the beginning of the call, and that was "papas." Now that seems like gibberish, right? Except for one little fact, that Pappas is William Kennedy's middle name and the name he typically goes by. Mic drop. Could it be he was just trying to say that he had dropped him off? Perhaps, but still, it's really weird. Now, I got really excited finding this article, but it's really important to note there have been inconsistencies in Corrine's story, according to law enforcement. It's also reported that the relationship between Corrine and law enforcement grew cold and callous. Supposedly, Corrine ended up, quote unquote, firing them, whatever that means. A mediator between law enforcement and citizens named David Singleton was quoted saying, quote, "We feel like we have all been misled," unquote. And, quote, "We have an ethical and moral obligation to the community and to this organization to do the right thing," unquote. And then he was also quoted stating he believes Corrine might have been withholding information. But to this day, Corrine maintains she was being truthful with the police. So where does that leave us today? Nowhere, unfortunately. There have been no leads in the death of Henry McCabe. There was thought to be a possible connection to crime in Liberia. However, that lead ended up going cold. At the end of the day, my biggest question is, what happened to Henry McCabe? Was he murdered or did he stumble into a body of water? Was he met with ill fate or instead was it an accident? The biggest clue, in my opinion, that leads to the conclusion of murder is whoever said, "Stop it," at the end of the call. But what if his phone was truly dismantled in his pocket? Why would Henry do that? Also, why would he say he was shot when there was absolutely no indication of that clinically during his autopsy? Did the perpetrator tell him to act crazy? I mean, if there even was one? Henry did not seem like the type to commit suicide either. I could find no history of mental health issues, and he seemed that he was living the American dream. I can honestly say that even after researching the case, I am still stumped as far as what I believed happened to Henry. Henry McCabe's death is one of the most bizarre cases I personally have ever heard of, and honestly, because there's so little actually known, I don't know if this case will ever have a true ending. I'm truly hopeful, but unless something comes to light, this case will continue to haunt those involved. If you have any information regarding the death of Henry McCabe, please contact the Minnesota Community Policing Services at 651-485-9211. Do you have any thoughts or ideas as far as what happened to Henry McCabe? Don't hesitate to reach out on social media or email me at victimologypod.com. This one is a true head scratcher. And at the end of the day, I don't know if it's murder or accident or suicide. I feel like it should be on that show. But we don't know enough about the case. That's why this episode wasn't that long, which is kind of a shame. Well, folks, that about does it for this week's episode. I'm Melissa Lee, and this has been Victimology. Victimology is partnered with the Oracle Network. Make sure to subscribe to Victimology on your favorite podcast platform. Like and follow Victimology on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you like what we do, please consider giving Victimology a 5-star review on iTunes. Victimology is always accepting case suggestions. Please reach out via social media or email victimologypod@gmail.com.